Welcome to the Liberated Body Podcast, helping you to more happily inhabit your body with your host, Brooke Thomas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of the Liberated Body Podcast. This is Brooke, and I am totally delighted to bring you today's talk with Esther Gokhale of the Gokhale Method. She has for a long time been somebody who I have really admired for the work that she's done. Anyone who's a good friend of mine knows and makes fun of me for starting way too many sentences with the phrase, in our culture, we. In our culture, we are really sedentary. In our culture, we're missing lateral hip stabilization, whatever it is. I start way too many sentences that way. And I can't really think of anyone who has done the work to dig into this anthropological view and to really take the time to travel to and study more traditional cultures quite the way Esther Gokhale has. So I'm very excited about today's talk. There's a lot of things that we get into that are personally real fascinations of mine, and I'm sure will be for all of you body nerds out there as well. So some of the things that we're going to get into today are how the fashion industry has played a role in the pain epidemic. I ask her about what I find really interesting, which is that she doesn't demonize sitting or even really being sedentary. And something that I love is how much she focuses on that the problem isn't what, but it's how. Not that she's encouraging anyone to sit around all day long, but she's looking at the nuance of how we make our shapes and how we accomplish our movements. The J spine versus the S spine. This is really what kind of turned me onto her work initially, because I have a private practice myself and I've been trained to view the S spine shape as what is ideal. And she talks about how she just didn't see that bearing out really in traditional cultures, and this explains what this J spine shape is. And then one other thing that came out of her work looking at traditional cultures, and that's really a particular fascination of mine right now, or something that I'm playing with a lot in my own movement practice, is, you know, are we at a disadvantage in our culture because we don't have any tradition of head carrying? And how does that affect our necks? So lots of stuff to tuck into for sure. And let me tell you a little bit more about her. So she has been involved in the integrative therapies all her life. An early interest in healing led her to study biochemistry at Harvard and Princeton, and later acupuncture at the San Francisco School of Oriental Medicine. After experiencing crippling back pain during her first pregnancy and an unsuccessful back surgery even, which she talks about in the interview a bunch as well, that began her lifelong crusade to vanquish back pain. Her studies at the Aplomb Institute in Paris and years of research in Brazil, India, Portugal, and elsewhere, which you can see amazing photos of in her book, and I highly recommend, is what led her to develop the Gokhale Method, which is a unique systematic approach to help people restore their natural posture. And the Gokhale Method is growing with teachers worldwide. Her award-winning book of the amazing photographs that I just mentioned, 8 Steps to a Pain-Free Back, has sold over 100,000 copies and has been translated into 10 languages. In 2010, she hosted a nationally televised program, Back Pain, the Primal Posture Solution. Who doesn't love that subtitle? And she has been a speaker and teacher at corporations such as Google. Maybe you've heard of some of these: Google, IDEO, Varian Medical Systems, and conferences including TEDx Stanford, Ancestral Health Symposium, Weston Price Foundation Conference, and PrimalCon. She also speaks with medical physician groups, including Stanford, UCSF, and sports teams such as the trainers of the San Francisco 49ers and several Stanford teams. Her method has been featured in many publications, including the New York Times, where she was given the title, the Posture Guru of Silicon Valley. So clearly she has a lot of wisdom to share. I'm really excited that she has shared it with us today. And if you want more information on her work, that's at gokhalemethod.com. That's spelled G-O-K-H-A-L-E. So it's not, doesn't sound and spell the same way, but it's G-O-K-H-A-L-E-method.com if you want to look at that more. Without further ado, let's hear from the woman herself. Here's Esther.
So thank you so much, Esther, for speaking with us today and all the Liberated listeners.
I'm very glad to be here.
So why don't we start off with you telling us in your own words about your work that you do and how, you know, the journey that led you to create the Gokhale Method?
I came at this the hard way, like many people do, from having very severe issues. I had a herniated L5 S1 disc, and it was a very large herniation and caused me much misery. I was 9 months pregnant with my first child, and it persisted after the baby was born, and it got worse and worse and wouldn't respond to any of the conservative or alternative techniques that I tried. And eventually I had surgery, and that was a shock to my system, but I needed to do something because I was not able to sleep through the night. I was waking up every 2 hours to get out and having to walk around the block to get out a very severe spasm in my back. And then I'd get to sleep another 2 hours, you know, so it was horrible. Mm. And the surgery gave some relief, but a year later I had the same problem. And I was offered another surgery. And so, you know, that was clearly not the solution either. And so that's what set me on my journey. You know, I felt there had to be a better way and there had to be some solution. I was in my mid-20s. It didn't make any sense to me that I, of all people who had been very athletic, had been a yoga model in Bombay, very careful about my health, would be, you know, a cripple in my mid-20s. Mm-hmm. So that's what set me looking to other techniques, you know, broader, wider. I looked at especially techniques that teach you how to use your own body. That's what made sense to me because I had tried a lot of Band-Aid approaches, you know, more strong Band-Aids and more lightweight Band-Aids, but it was other people doing things to me and that had not worked. And so I was attracted to techniques like Alexander technique and Feldenkrais and Aplomb and Mensendieck because those were about how you move and how you structure your body. And what also attracted me was techniques that looked to functional populations. That made a lot of sense to me. I was raised in India, mom's Dutch, father's Indian. And my mom is an Indophile and always very, very aware of the high level of physicality and functionality of the sweepers and the fruit carriers and, you know, people who could carry large loads for long periods and not get into trouble. And so that was imprinted in my memory. And so when, you know, some techniques like Aplomb especially, and Mensendieck watched the Balinese, and Alexander was, you know, he was aware of Aborigine footprints and so on. And that drew me. That made sense to me. I had also read the work of Weston Price when I was in college, and that blew me away. Couldn't implement very well in college because you're eating dorm food. Right. But you know, those are the things that resonated, and I learned bits and pieces from many techniques, and I immersed myself in Aplomb, and then I started traveling and taking photographs and video clips and interviewing people. And anyway, so that was the beginning of my method.
Yeah, and you have a lot of great resources and inspirations. And one of the things that I just really adore about your work is that you take such an anthropological view, and you have great, you know, if people get your book, you have great photographs, just beautiful pictures of people in more traditional cultures, you know, moving in much more natural ways than we do.
I use photographs for several reasons. One is they just, you know, it is true that a picture speaks 1,000 words sometimes. But we also have a very developed visual cortex. So why not use it? You know, people are naturally mimics. So I like to use images for that reason. And then it also draws, it's compelling, you know, it sort of says, hey, this is worthwhile. It's good advertisement to the soul, you know. like, hey, this is something I want to do. I want to look like that, you know?
Yeah, and I do, especially when I look at the necks of the people who you've photographed. Because I'm a neck person. And, you know, back pain, like you said, that's how you got into the field, is healing your own pain is clearly an epidemic in our culture. And I think pain and physical erosion in general is right now. And you talk about two main culprits that you believe kick this off, which are a loss of kinesthetic tradition and the fashion industry. And I think both are hugely important points. So why don't we talk about each one a little bit at a time? And since we were kind of getting into it a bit already, can you talk a little bit about loss of kinesthetic tradition first?
Well, it used to be that people were raised in a village, more or less, and with a clan, and that you would have the input of all the elders around. You would be seeing grandfather in the bending over and gathering, and grandmother would have influence over how baby was being carried, you know. And that has been lost in modern culture. You know, with industrial cultures, you have a lot of moving around, transplanting, and then a parent is on their own as far as wisdom on how to carry that kid. They have to make it up from scratch. They don't have people advising, informing, correcting. And so we lose that root, you know, in our, this old wisdom, I call it, kinesthetic tradition, that gets handed down in cultures like Village Africa and, you know, places where people still stay put and have their extended families around, and their communities around, both to mimic, to model, and to mold. So I think in modern cultures, human beings are not modeled and not molded well. And that brings us to the second negative influence, which is this loss of fashion, you know, the negative influence of the fashion industry. About 100 years ago, it became fashionable to tuck. The flapper era, and you know, there's a whole generation of people who kind of tried to make their bottoms disappear. Mm-hmm. and then a result of that, up higher in the structures, that your upper body slinks forward. And that was considered cool. It was around World War I. Society needed to recreate itself, needed a refresh. And so old posture was sort of reframed as rigid and passé. And this new aesthetic with the tucked pelvis and the slinky look came to connote relaxed and easygoing ways. And in that, I feel we lost the baby with the bathwater, you know? Like maybe we needed to have a different society, but when it comes to something like your spinal architecture, that's not something that's up for grabs, you know? Fashion really shouldn't touch that. You know, they need to fashion things around a healthy human frame. You know, you can't just go reinventing spinal structure, because it's unlikely to be an improvement
right. On
what nature took, 5.5 million years to evolve, because that's how long we've been upright. And, you know, I think it's been well figured out by nature. And, Yeah,
I was looking. It's interesting. I was at the dentist a few months ago, maybe 6 months ago, and they had a Vogue magazine. And so I was like, oh, I haven't looked at one of these in a while. And I flipped through it, and their sort of big fashion spread that went on for many pages had a woman who was severely, in a very exaggerated way, holding her head really forward. I was just thinking about how, you know, you're talking about what kicked this off, which was in the 20s, the flapper culture of slouching. And this was like texting neck taken to an extreme degree. And I was like, oh, no, are people going to start to decide that this is attractive? Because she looks really uncomfortable.
It has been decided that it's attractive. I mean, the entire fashion industry celebrates that structure, the tucked pelvis and the kind of slinky, slouchy look. And it's a pity, and it's up to us as a society to put different pressures on the fashion industry. You know, we need to not go for the heroine look.
Right.
We need to recognize what's healthy and start reconnecting our tastes with what's healthy and actually functions well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, speaking of just how we use our bodies differently and how that might impact things, one of the things that caught my attention about your work is that you don't really demonize sitting, and you don't even really demonize being sedentary, which happens a lot, and I certainly do my fair share of doing that. And so you talk a lot about that the problem isn't that we sit, or the problem isn't that we're stationary. Maybe it's how, you know, how we sit and how we're stationary.
I mean, and you know, we, in moderation, you know,
right.
I think it's obviously if someone's just sitting there like a lump on a log for 8 hours, that is not healthy. Nobody did that. And I always use as my argument, you know, the our hunter-gatherer ancestors, and our, you don't even have to go that far back, you know, what to point out what is natural for our species. So long periods of stationary sitting, nobody's ever done that historically. And so I suspect that the body is not, and we know that the body is not well adapted to that. But sitting has become, it has gotten demonized, like sitting kills. But, you know, the Buddha sat, all these sages and meditators and so on, you know, and there's a reason they sit. And because when you sit, you can, and there's research backing this, that's when your brain can be most focused. And so if you throw out sitting, you're throwing out the deepest thoughts. My husband is a mathematician, and I don't want him to not be able to sit. It's very clear that that quiet allows focused thinking, deep thinking. And I think it's been part of our heritage to sit. When we were scraping hides and tanning hides and making arrows, we were sitting. And I don't think there was anything wrong with that sitting, provided we interspersed it with getting up and, you know, moving a little, going and getting a drink of water, whatever would naturally interrupt people. And also that there be somewhere in your life where you're pushing your boundaries, you know, in flexibility, in cardiovascular output, in strength and lifting and so on. Somewhere in your life you want to push your boundaries, just like our ancestors did. Once in a while they had to chase something, or they were chased by something, or they had to pick something up that was heavy and drag it home. And all of that, because it's part of our heritage, I think is also part of our set of needs. You know, the human genome hasn't changed that much in the last, you know, since we've become industrial. There's very little change. Mm-hmm. So genetically, we are hunter-gatherers. And so I always like to use that filter to see how, even though we are in modern contexts and we are in totally different settings, there's some principles that still hold. And I think some sitting was done all through history. It's fine. It's very important to sit well. That is critical, because if you're going to tuck your pelvis and be slumped forward, then it's not this. It's, of course, that position is going to do harm. You can't breathe well. You can't circulate well. Your blood won't circulate. You can't breathe. You can't heal well. You know, digestion gets blocked. Excretion is not optimal in those kind of tucked positions, and so on. And so, you know, it behooves you to respect your natural structure and sit with the same kind of spinal structure you had when you're standing or walking. And then I think done in moderation, it can be a very restful position, one that allows you deep thought, that allows you some rest. Because if you're moving all the time, if you're, you know, like now they have treadmill desks and so on, I think constant movement, if it's walking, it's fine, I think. And again, it depends how you walk, the way some people walk with a heavy tread or with poorly architectured legs, you know, pronated feet, knock knees and so on. Then I don't think walking or standing is that good for you either. You know, it all depends on how you do it. I think it's all good. It's all good, and how you do it is critical.
Yeah, that's a really hugely important point, that it's the how in front of the what, you know, that's the most important. And, you know, speaking of movements and actions, something that I thought was interesting is that you say that bending technique, or just, you know, how we bend to pick things up, that you have found that that correlates most closely with back health. And you have just beautiful pictures of people in their, I don't know how old they are, but probably 70s, maybe 80s, maybe older, and in more traditional cultures, and they're bending beautifully. So can you talk a little bit about what you mean by bending technique and how the listeners can tinker with that themselves?
Sure. It's a technique I don't like to introduce to beginners, especially those in back with back pain, because what you first want to do is lengthen and reshape the spine and bolster it and strengthen all the muscles around it. So you have good length, good strength, good shape. And now you want to preserve all of that length and shape as you bend. And I call it hip hinging, because really the only place that there's movement is at the hip hinge. Now, what's also very important to be able to hip hinge well is to have the femurs, the leg bones, upper leg bones, out of the way, because very many people have some degree of pronation. And unfortunately, they're sometimes encouraged to have their legs slightly internally rotated, like the whole directions about having your feet run parallel, facing forward, I think is misguided and encourages a small degree of internal rotation at, in the whole leg. And then that makes it very difficult for the pelvis to nest where it belongs. Yeah, in my description, and anytime I, you know, in my philosophy, it is always a reflection of what you observe in these village cultures and in old cultures, and also in little kids, by the way. So, you know, even close at hand, we have good models, good examples of how we might do these things better. And what you see there is that their feet turn out a little, but they also have this characteristic shape I describe as a kidney bean shape. And with that kidney bean shape, you have a small external rotation all through the leg. It also helps to have, you know, some tone in the appropriate glute muscles, your gluteus muscles, and gluteus medius, for example, to help externally rotate to the leg. And then once you have that in place, and see, this is why I don't teach it in lesson one, because we need to train people to externally rotate their legs, to have good length and shape in their spines. And now it's very, very simple. The only place that moves is the hip joint. So the whole torso in one, as one unit, like one of those ducky birds drinking water, hinges at the hip. But it doesn't run into the leg bones at any point, because the leg bones are externally rotated out of the way. And now you can settle your entire torso between the legs. And it keeps completely straight. It keeps its original structure. And, you know, they're straight and they're straight. So a lot of people think they're bending with the straight back when they're actually rounding a little bit, especially you don't want to round in the lower back, you know, at the bottom of the hip, L5, S1, L4, L5. Those discs are the ones that are the most subject to strain of all sorts, and they're the ones that get most often into trouble. So when you're bending, if you round at that level, that's a big problem. You know, then you're loading those discs and it's terrible. And you should not do this technique unless you are very sure that you're doing it precisely. So I recommend to people that they work with a qualified teacher. And we have now we have teachers all over the world. I've trained teachers to teach our 6-lesson foundations course all over the U.S. and abroad. We have teachers in Europe and in India and in South America. And so it's available. And it doesn't take much training, but the training is critical. And then it becomes not only safe, but actually good for you. You know, bending, if it's done well, is a fantastic workout. It stretches your hamstrings. It stretches your external hip rotators. It strengthens your rhomboids. It strengthens your back muscles. I mean, it is fabulous, and it doesn't do any damage to the discs and the ligaments. But that's only true if you are doing it very, very well, very precisely. So this is a tricky one. And, you know, I used to have one of my old logos had this beautiful hip hinge, and I discontinued it, using it, because it's not a good statement up front. Mm. It's just not a good beginning technique. First, you want to do all these other homework.
Yeah, you make a really good point about foundations and, you know, gradually, incrementally getting to where you're going. And I just wanted to back up a little bit, because you had talked about, you know, the place that gets into the most trouble being that L5-S1 area, which I don't even think you have to be in the fields that we're in anymore to know, because everyone's walking around saying, yeah, I have a herniation, L5-S1. People know that term, even if they're not at all anatomically inclined. And, you know, I was first introduced to your work actually by watching a talk you gave at the Ancestral Health Symposium.
Yeah.
And I'll put, for those of you listening, I'll put that in the show notes, a link to that talk. And I was really interested in how you talked about the wedge-shaped disc at L5-S1 and the idea of a J-shaped spine being ideal, as opposed to this S-shaped spine that people talk about a lot.
Yeah. You know, the earth was flat for many hundred years until it became round, right? You know, we can be misguided for very extended periods. And just because everybody believes something doesn't make it true. And so here we have this notion in modern times that the spine is supposed to be S-shaped. Every ergonomic chair is fit to that shape, you know, a little bit lumbar adjustment and lumbar curvature, lumbar rolls. And, you know, does it really represent accurately what is healthy? You know, what is it really representing? And my observation is that it's reflecting what's average in modern times. You know, medical illustrators want to draw what they see. And what we see in modern times is often this S-shaped curve. You know, you look at x-rays and you draw from that. And if everybody's spine looks that way, then it's easy to think that that is a normal human characteristic. But I argue that it's not normal, it doesn't really make sense, and that it gives rise to a lot of pathology. And so the first argument I present, and in my book I have these two spines right next to each other, a spine from a modern anatomy book and a spine from an anatomy book published in 1911. And they look extremely different. And clearly, you know, it's not like evolution changed the human structure in the space of 80 years, right? It's our perception of what is normal that has changed. And so if you go back to this old textbook, you see what I describe more as a J spine, where the bottom part is out back. Your bum is out behind you. But up above that, it looks pretty straightened out. There's some curvature, but not nearly as much as is described in modern textbooks. So that's one argument, because this comes from a time where people didn't have so much back problems. So they were seeing different things and they didn't have so much back problems. So that's kind of suggestive. Like maybe they knew better. Their notions were informed by a better model. The second argument is, if you look at the fine structures within those spines, it becomes very obvious that the J spine, with this flattened lumbar area, respects much better the disc shape, the cylindrical shape of all of those lumbar discs. You know, they're like little hockey pucks. And if you look at an S-shaped spine, those hockey puck-like shaped discs are getting squished into a wedge shape. It makes no sense. And if that's what we're doing day in and day out, which is the case for most people these days, no wonder so many of us have degenerative disc disease and problems with our backs. And then you also look at the bones, you know, in the old J spine, the bones are stacked face to face. Well, that helps with preventing osteoporosis. You want weight bearing that is appropriate. But in the S-shaped arrangement, you have the edges of the bones kind of stressed against each other. And that doesn't make any sense and would explain why so many of us have spinal arthritis in our spines by the time we're 50. You know, if that's what you're doing, you're edgewise compressing your vertebrae, then yeah, no wonder there's all kinds of bony deposition to try and protect that part of the bone. So it just doesn't make sense. And you're in, and then when you look around at, you know, the kind of populations I'm talking about, including kids and people in non-industrial cultures, and you see that they have this J-spine together with our ancestors. Well, that makes it very compelling because these are the people who have less incidence of back problems. So I, you know, it's enough argument, I think, to convince people to try this out. And, you know, results are ultimately what speak volumes.
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. It certainly changed, you know, the way that I look at things. I love that. I love that you bring that up. And, you know, one other thing, something we're definitely missing out on in our culture is head carrying. You know, it's just not culturally okay to walk down the street carrying stuff on our head. And it's kind of a current fascination of mine. And you have a lot of beautiful pictures of women carrying large loads on their heads with just these cervical spines that are so elongated and beautifully stacked. And, you know, do you think that we're at a disadvantage in our culture because we don't use our heads for carrying? Or
I have come to the conclusion that we're really missing out in that respect. If you have to carry on your head, it keeps your neck and the rest of your spine honest, so to speak. You know, there's no way that you can carry significant weights on your head and be off. It would just do immediate strain and damage, and you would get immediate feedback, and you would have to straighten out. And without carrying on our weights, on our heads, we do kind of get away with all kinds of curves and warps in our spine and that do long-term damage. So I am also, like you, working on my neck, interested in the neck. And in spite of everything that I know to be healthy and I arrange things, I find that the neck is the most sort of hard to get. And you can't see it. That's one of the problems with the neck. You can't see your own neck. You can see your own back in a, you know, more easily. You can see the torso anyway. You know, you can see if your ribs are popping up and so on. You're more in touch with, but the neck is hard to see. So I have discovered that putting a small weight on the head is about the very best way to line everything up. And I'm convinced that it's a very primal experience, that there all the little stabilizer muscles all through your neck and spine immediately say, oh yeah, we know this, you know, and gear into action. I think, you know, it takes less training. So if you put small amount of weight, it just lines everything up. So I have actually recently, my most recent product, and I'm actually proud of being very product light. I've created a chair and a cushion because I do think sitting is okay to do, but then you want to sit well. So I've, you know, my chair helps people stretch, sit and stack, sit and keep this J spine and so on. And that's it though. You know, I have like four products, and this latest one is a head cushion. It's a small weight, and it's just a stuffed, and I had to think hard about stuffing it with stuff that's not going to be mildewy and so on, because if people are in the rain or whatever, it should last. And so it's washable, but I have it next to my computer. And whenever I do my emails, I place it on my head, and it immediately, all the inner parts of me know what to do with this. You know, it just lines me up really well. I notice that my voice drops, it changes, and I don't waggle my head as much to express myself. I think, you know, if you go to Village Africa, it's very striking how still people are with their heads. They use their eyes a lot more than we do, and their heads a lot less. So your eye muscles get more exercise and your neck gets less strain. It makes a lot of sense. But anyway, with this thing on your head, that happens automatically. And it also trains you to turn your head on its natural axis. It's very, very helpful. And so we just put that on our website. And people are reporting, and I'm starting to get photographs and feedback from people who are wearing it around, you know, notwithstanding that the culture is not exactly accepting of this, or some of our teachers are reporting to me that they've started carrying stuff on their head. They're kind of training their way up. Like our teacher Kathleen said, she just carried her groceries home that way. So it's a little self-conscious, but it was felt really good. And that, if I had my druthers, I would set that as a fashion, like that it became okay again to carry on your head. Interestingly, my husband intuitively arrived at this. Like whenever he has a suitcase or so to carry, he carries it on his head. There's some things, you know, some people will just arrive at intuitively.
Yeah, I love it. I'm so glad I asked. I didn't even know that you had that new product on the site. I'll definitely check it out because I've just been playing with this a ton at home. Like when I sit in meditation, I'll put a pillow from my bed on my head, or, you know, my son and I are walking around the house and the neighborhood with like books and stuff on our head, or his backpack filled with a bunch of toys. And it's been really fun. It really changes things, I think, pretty fast.
It really does. Yeah. Very fast. And then when you take it off, you still have that trace. You have a memory of the weight on your head, and you continue to carry your head that way for a while. So that if you really did put something on your head like every 15 minutes, which is something I recommend to people, by the way, in line with this recommendation about not sitting too long in one spot, I always recommend to my students every 15 minutes, set your iPhone, you know, to go off with your favorite tune and stand up. You know, all you have to do is stand up and then sit back down again, and you get G forces. Okay. And then while you're doing that, why not tack on one posture practice that you are trying to improve? So if it's head lengthening, you could just put something on your head, stand up, and then sit down, go back to your work. And if you do that, you know, and you have a job that involves sitting, you've done 35 reps a day, and it is well on its way to becoming a habit.
Yeah. I mean, you're building a pretty sophisticated proprioceptive map, you know, by doing those things.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And I've already disclosed my current obsession, which is the head carrying and how it helps my neck. And so a lot of us in these fields who are just interested in how we live in these human bodies, we have stuff that we're fascinated by currently. So is there anything, whether in your own body right now, or I know you said you're working on your neck too, or with clients or your teachers that you're fascinated by right now?
Oh, there's so much. One thing I'm sort of honing in on is keeping track and remembering, you know. So it's easy for us to totally convince people who show up in our courses that this is how they want to use their bodies. And they learn a lot. And then what we want to do is keep it, like not have this backslide, because they go out into the big wide world where people are round back bending and slump sitting, and they're being directed, you know, they go back to their exercise class and they're being directed to tuck their pelvis and do this and do that and sit up straight and stand up straight, all of which are counterproductive directions. And I, you know, there's so much out there, like crunches and so on. There's just so much damage to be had. And so how do we keep these little nuggets, these little pieces of posture wisdom that people easily digest? How do we keep it in their system and ongoing? So that is my, you know, how do I have a long arm so that they can remember after the course? You know, we have various online offerings and we do this and we do that, but that's what I'm preoccupied with, you know, because my agenda is to change the culture. Mm-hmm. You know, posture is a cultural matter. And I work one person at a time, and I'm very intent on working with groups, and we've been doing more of that in companies and with families. And then what we need is to get the whole community on board so that everybody is reminding each other of these beautiful habits and how to stay healthy and energetic and be your best looking, all of those things together.
Well, thank you truly and genuinely from the bottom of my heart for doing this work that you're doing to change culture. I think it's very important and that you're doing just beautiful work in that space.
Thank you very much. People like you help make it happen, get the word out.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for talking with me and all of the liberated listeners today.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, there you have it. Wow. That's some pretty amazing stuff, I think. I think she's got a lot of really great insight. So hopefully you enjoyed it as much as I did. Thank you again so much for listening to the Liberated Body podcast. And just a reminder that the show notes live at liberatedbody.com. So links to any resources that we mentioned will be found there for sure. You can just go to the podcast page and you'll see this interview. You can click on it and it'll have all the specifics. And her website again is the goklaymethod.com. So that's, sorry, not the goklaymethod.com, G-O-K-H-A-L-E method.com. So you can get a lot more of her good stuff there. And home play. It's home play time. So I think you know where I'm going with this one. I hinted at it in the intro. So last week we were talking about walking, full body walking for home play. And so now can we do full body walking with head carrying? So don't go nuts, you know, don't like put your car on your head or whatever, but you know, walking with head carrying or just sitting with head carrying. I mentioned it in the interview and I've found it really useful when I'm sitting at home meditating. I'll just put a lightweight bed pillow on my head and it changes my posture a lot and it changes how I feel afterwards a lot. So in whatever way it feels safe and useful to play with this, give it a try. As I learned the first time I started playing with head carrying a few months ago, you cannot head carry and do anything other than head carry. I thought I was going to put my son's backpack on my head and cook dinner. That did not go great. So you need to be able to have your, and it's really only what's safe for your neck, have your eyes straight ahead. You can maybe look a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right, but you're not going to be cooking dinner with something on your head. So play, let me know how it goes. Let me know in the reviews in iTunes. You can also email me. Speaking of reviews in iTunes, I got my first review. So thank you, MMY. That's your iTunes name. She or he wrote, "Love listening to Brooke's interviews as I walk, crawl, climb, cook, and move around the house. Really glad to see it in the Apple Store. Can't wait to hear more." Thank you so much for being my first reviewer. That's so sweet. And I'm so glad that I'm accomplishing my goal, that people can finally get this information and not be chained to the screen for even longer periods of time. So this is mobile learning. This is what we love. So if you are feeling inspired, please do leave a review. I would love that so much. It means so much to me. It also helps me make the show better. And it makes iTunes think that, you know, we're doing something valuable here and helps other people find it. So that's a good thing. I will be back next week. Every Tuesday we have a new episode, Liberated Tuesday. I look forward to talking with you all then. Thank you.